So we're in Exodus, and Exodus 14, verses 13 to 31 is our passage this morning. And it's an event then which has caught the imagination of artists and filmmakers and archaeologists and Sunday school teachers and within the Bible itself, poets and songwriters. I'm talking about the crossing of the Red Sea. But I'm none of those things. My job this morning isn't to dramatize the event on the big screen or verify the event by analyzing the evidence or lyricize the event in elegant verse. My job as a preacher is to explain and apply the meaning of the event. And in an attempt to do that, I just want to draw your attention to three things in this text. So first of all, notice God fights crucially. That's our first heading. God fights crucially. How would you summarize what God did for the Israelites on this epic occasion? I wonder what language you would use. Well, four times in our passage, we're given a summary of what God did for the Israelites here. The summaries actually form two pairs. So in verse 13 and then again in verse 30, we have the language of saving. That's what God did for the Israelites at the Red Sea. He saved. So that's one pair. The other pair is in verses 14 and 25. There we have the language of fighting. That's what God did for the Israelites at the Red Sea. He fought. Interestingly, in verse 25, that summary comes from the Egyptians. The Lord fights for them, they cry in panic there. So four descriptions of what God was up to on behalf of his people, two highlighting his saving activity and two highlighting his fighting activity. And we're not meant to perceive a tension here, as though the passage cannot make up its mind what God was doing. Rather, these descriptions are complementary. Indeed, the way that they're arranged may well be significant. So the two references to saving are, as it were, on the outside. Verses 13 and 30, the two references to fighting are then enclosed between in verse 14 and 25. In Hebrew literature, things like that are rarely accidental. By putting the saving statements at the edges of the passage and the fighting statements more at the heart of the passage, the writer is probably saying this: at the heart of God's saving is his fighting. At the heart of God's saving is his fighting. Now, to our modern evangelical ears, that perhaps sounds an odd sentence. At the heart of God's saving is his fighting. I mean, God's saving, we're always talking about that, aren't we? It's one of our favorite themes. But we don't tend to talk much about God fighting. And certainly we don't talk about the two activities together in the same breath. In our minds, if God fights at all, then that's something very different from and unrelated to his work of saving. But I would put it to you that the reason we're comfortable with God saving and comparatively uncomfortable with God fighting is that we haven't thought deeply enough about what salvation is. You see, usually in the Bible, what God's people need saving from is an enemy, some power or other that is oppressing them. So that necessarily, in the act of saving his people, God has to fight. He has to take on and defeat the oppressive enemy. If that's the plight his people are in, if some evil foe is the problem they're facing, then a peaceful, non-combative salvation, a salvation where God doesn't go on the warpath, that's no salvation at all. And that then is why God saving here in Exodus 14 involves him fighting. Because Israel's problem at the Red Sea, we need to grasp this, Israel's problem at the Red Sea is not a topographical one. It isn't that there's a large body of water in their way, obstructing their route to the land of Canaan. No, Israel's problem is the Egyptians. The Egyptians pursuing them, determined to capture them and enslave them. That's Israel's problem. And so God saves his people by fighting those Egyptians. God saves his people not primarily by dividing the waters and ensuring the Israelites get to the other side of the sea. That's what we tend to focus on in our children's songs. How did Moses cross the Red Sea and all the rest of it? But that's not the main thing. No, God saves his people primarily by reunifying the waters and ensuring the Egyptians get to the bottom of the sea. That's how he saves his people here. He saves his people not as a conveyor god who executes this marvelous Red Sea crossing. He saves his people as a fighter god who executes this gruesome Red Sea drowning. And so, as I say, usually in the Bible, it's enemy oppression that God's people need saving from. And so his saving must involve fighting. And Exodus 14 is a classic example of that. But we can't move on, can we, without tracing this motif to where it really comes into its own. And that is in our salvation. All the other saving acts of God in the Bible point, of course, to that one supreme saving act. And in this aspect, this warring, battling, enemy-defeating aspect, they point to that one supreme saving act of God. You see, we often talk about our salvation as being the answer to man's lostness. Human beings are lost. We like to use that word, don't we? And it suggests this picture then of men and women groping about, unable to find their way to heaven. And so God in Jesus opens up a path for us to get there. And that's salvation. That's the great salvation that the Bible is ultimately all about. And there's some truth in that depiction. And indeed, there's some biblical warrant for the language of human beings outside of salvation being lost. Jesus uses that kind of language occasionally, doesn't he? But we need to realize that is not the whole story by any means. The word lost does not exhaust the plight that human beings are in. There's way more to it than that. Our natural condition is a condition of enemy oppression. Horrid, hellish, helpless enemy oppression, whereby we follow the prince of the power of the air, Ephesians 2, verse 2, whereby we inhabit the dominion of darkness, Colossians 1, 13, whereby we are under the power of Satan, Acts 26, 18, whereby, along with the whole world, we lie in the power of the evil one, 1 John 5, 19. That's our natural condition. We're not merely lost and in need of a divine waymaker. We are held captive and in need of a divine warrior. We need a God who fights. A God who says cleanly and politely and decorously, that's no good for us. That's no good to men and women in chains under Satan's fierce tyranny. We want a God who says grittily and brutally. A God who goes in all guns blazing. That's what I mean in my heading by God fights crucially. This really is crucial. We can put it like this. Either he is a fighting warrior God, or we are still Satan's miserable prisoners. Rejoice this morning, believer. Rejoice this morning that he is a fighting warrior God. That in the language of the next chapter in verse 3, the Lord is a man of war. The Lord is a man of war. Rejoice that the God who reigns in heaven is no gentlemanly Father Christmas won't say boo to a goose kind of figure. He's a God who is up to the task of saving his elect from their formidable foe. He's a fighting God, an armed God, a combative God, a martial God. A God who goes to the enemy and defeats the enemy. God fights crucially. What a God we have. God fights crucially. Notice with me secondly this morning. Moses features centrally. So the passage is emphatic that God brings about this salvation at the Red Sea. It's his doing. But that doesn't mean that he brings it about in such a way that nobody else is remotely relevant. It's clear in the passage that someone else is relevant. It's clear that God acts here through an agent, through an intermediary, or in the precise language of our text, through a servant. That's the word we find in verse 31. And that servant then, through whom God does what he does here, that servant is Moses. It's interesting that four times in the passage, Moses' hand is mentioned. The waters of the Red Sea divide and then reunify as he stretches out his hand, verse 16, verse 21, verse 26, and verse 27. But then when you go to verse 31, it reads literally in the Hebrew, Israel saw not the great power that the Lord used, but the great hand that the Lord used against the Egyptians. So here suddenly God's hand comes into focus. And that focus then on the same body part, I think, emphasizes this point that Moses is Yahweh's agent. Moses' hand, as it were, mediates God's hand. And once again, then, this is familiar biblical territory, isn't it? In his great interventions on behalf of his people, God usually does act through a servant, whether it's guys like Gideon and Barak and Samson, whom we encounter in the book of Judges, or whether it's David, who comes along later. God involves, and involves quite significantly, these human channels. And once again, this, I would suggest, is another feature pointing towards God's ultimate salvation. For there, God acts through a servant. When it comes to our salvation, there are not just three parties involved. The people who need saving, the enemy from whom they need saving, and the God who does the saving. There's another extremely prominent party involved, Jesus, of course. The servant of the Lord, as the Bible calls him, through whom the whole thing comes about. Now, you might be thinking, here he goes. These preachers, no matter where they're preaching from, they always like to bring Jesus in as soon as they possibly can. They'll seize on any excuse the text throws up to go to Jesus. Well, if you are thinking something like that, I would say in the first place, I think when you get a pattern running through God's saving acts that's as pronounced as this one, God so invariably saving in this way through a human servant, then I think there are good grounds for tracing that pattern all the way to God's ultimate saving act and seeing it fulfilled in Jesus. So even just at that level, I'm unapologetic about bringing Jesus into the picture here. But actually, in this particular instance, I think we have even stronger warrant to talk about Jesus. I say that for two reasons. First, the extraordinary language of verse 31. Where we read, Israel saw the great hand that the Lord used against the Egyptians, so the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. Wow. Israel's faith here is in both Yahweh and his servant, the text is clearly saying. And it's not described disapprovingly, is it? As though this was something highly unsatisfactory that Israel placed their faith both in Yahweh and in his servant. It's presented as something reasonable and appropriate. Now, surely it can only be appropriate for the Israelites to place their faith in Moses, even as they place their faith in Yahweh. Surely it can only be appropriate insofar as Moses is a type, a preview, a forerunner, an anticipation of Christ. I mean, that verse immediately makes me think of John 14, verse 1, Jesus saying, believe in God, believe also in me. These twin objects of the Christian's faith. So the extraordinary language, I'm saying, of verse 31 warrants, I think, us making something of a beeline from this passage to Jesus. But then secondly, there's the equally extraordinary language of 1 Corinthians 10, verse 2. Paul says there that the Israelites were baptized into Moses in the sea. The Israelites were baptized into Moses in the sea. Now that's quite a statement, isn't it? What does Paul mean there? Well, in Paul's writings, being baptized into someone means being joined to that person so that you share in what that person has experienced. That's what this kind of terminology means in Paul's writing. Being baptized into someone is being joined to that person so that you share in what that person has experienced. How then were the Israelites on this occasion that we're looking at this morning in Exodus 14, how were they baptized there into Moses? I mean, we can see how the event might have strengthened their allegiance to Moses as they watched in admiration as his outstretched hand triggered all these convulsions in the waters of the Red Sea. We can see how the event might have strengthened their allegiance to their leader. But that's not what Paul is saying. Baptism into someone, I'm saying, is more than that. It's more than just having a certain bond, a certain allegiance to someone. It's being joined to that person and becoming a participant in their experiences. So how does that apply here? Well, the ESV lets us down somewhat in betraying no issues whatsoever with the name Red Sea. The NIV is more transparent. It always includes a footnote when it mentions the Red Sea, indicating that in the Hebrew the name is Sea of Reeds, not Red Sea. No one ever referred to this event that we're looking at this morning in terms of the Red Sea until well over a millennium later, when, for whatever reasons, the Greek translators of the Hebrew Old Testament, when they were writing what we now know as the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Old Testament, they translated Sea of Reeds, Red Sea, and it then took off and was incorporated into our English versions in that way. So this body of water, I'm saying, that's so prominent here in our passage, it is, in the Hebrew, the Sea of Reeds. And what happens here then is this. The Israelites go into a sea of reeds and amazingly come out alive. That's what happens here in Exodus 14. But does that remind you slightly at least of something? Does it remind you slightly at least of what happens in chapter 2 of Exodus? What happens there? Well, the infant Moses. He goes into a sea of reeds, into the Nile, with its reeds, specifically the same word mentioned there, and amazingly comes out alive. That's why he's called Moses, isn't it? Moses means to draw out. To draw out, in this case, of the sea of reeds, the Nile. And I think that may be the explanation for Paul's remark in 1 Corinthians 10:2. Listen to how one writer puts it. He says, what happened to the leader of the people later happens to the whole people at the Red Sea. As Israel enters into Moses' experience of deliverance from the waters, all witnessed once again by Miriam, because of course she was there, wasn't she, in Exodus 2, and she'll be prominent again in Exodus 15 as they celebrate on the shores of the Red Sea. So the Israelites then in the sea were baptized into Moses in that they came to share on that day in what he had previously experienced. And does that not point us then to how our salvation works? You see, at Calvary, Jesus went into a sea of reeds. The sea of reeds that Jonah talks about when he says in the passage we read earlier, Jonah chapter 2 verse 5, reeds, not weeds, ESV, reeds, same Hebrew word, were wrapped about my head. And yet he also describes that same place in that same passage as Sheol and the pit. At Calvary, Jesus went into that sea of reeds, into death, into the grip of Sheol. And amazingly, 3 days later, he came out alive. And what is a Christian then? A Christian is someone who is baptized into Christ and shares with him that deliverance from the sea of reeds, from death, shares with Christ his resurrection. In the future, shares it in a bodily sense, but shares it right now in a different sense, as Paul puts it in Romans 6:4, just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, we too walk in newness of life. So I'm saying then, Moses features centrally in this whole event, because in the last analysis, God saves through a person. He saves through someone. He saves through Jesus. Salvation in the full sense, the salvation the Bible is really about, it involves being baptized into Christ. If Christ means little to you this morning, if you have some vague sense because you come to church, because you're friends with Christians, if you have some vague sense that you're okay and you're right with God, but Christ means little to you, then you're not okay, you're not right with God, because the only salvation that there is this salvation where Christ is central and you're joined to Christ and Christ is everything. And conversely, if you are a saved person this morning, then that means you are someone who hasn't simply believed in Christ and it's this very kind of transactional thing and he's out there and you're here and you've stretched out your faith to him and that's as far as it goes. No, you are someone who has been joined to him, and you share in what he has experienced. In other words, the Easter Sunday morning event that we spoke of in our opening prayer this morning, that we sang of in our opening hymn, it has the most direct relevance to you this morning imaginable. It's not simply this historical event. It is a historical event. But it's not simply this event involving our hero, and so we like to sing about it and celebrate it because our hero was involved and won a victory on that day. No, our involvement with Easter Sunday morning is closer and more intimate and more existential than that. We experienced it too, because we have been baptized into this person who rose from the dead that morning. We are risen people. We have Jesus' resurrection life coursing through our veins. One day, in the fullest sense, that will be so, and we will rise bodily. But even now, we walk in newness of life, baptized into the risen Jesus Christ. Perhaps you don't feel that this morning. You feel bogged down like the Egyptian chariots we're going to talk about in a moment in the mud of the Red Sea. You feel bogged down in sin. And you feel not remotely new in your life. Come back to this morning and grasp anew that you are a risen person. Grasping that will be the starting point for living like that and living it out. Grasp this morning that you share in Jesus' resurrection from the dead. You're a risen person who now may walk in newness of life. Go into this week seeing yourself through biblical lenses and so determinedly walk in that newness of life. God fights crucially. Moses features centrally. Thirdly this morning, Egypt fails completely. Egypt fails completely. So what happens then to the Egyptians here, about whom we haven't talked much yet this morning? What happens to them, of course, is no mere setback. They don't marginally come off worse here. No, what happens to them is devastating. It's emphatic. It's ignominious. Egypt fails completely. And like in so many other Old Testament accounts, then, the complete failure here of an enemy is told, it seems to me, with relish. We can sense it being celebrated by the people of God. It's not told in a funereal way. It's not a lament, as it would be if this were the Israelites who had suffered some defeat. It's told with relish and with a celebratory feel to it. There are touches of humour, I would suggest, in the account. And there are just two quickly that I want to highlight then as we close this morning. Because as well as expressing this relish I'm talking about, these two touches of humour, they're also, I think, instructive for us this morning. So the first is Egypt's asset rebounds. Egypt's asset rebounds. What's their great asset? Their chariots. I mean, you can't miss that, can you, in the section we were looking at last week, and verses 6 and 7 of this chapter. So he, that's Pharaoh, made ready his chariots and took his army with him and took 600 chosen chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over them all. Three categories of chariots mentioned there. You have the royal chariot, Pharaoh's, you have the elite chariots, these 600 chosen ones, and then you have the ordinary common or garden chariots that are mentioned as well. And you sense, don't you, there, the pride of the Egyptians in this cutting-edge item of military hardware. The psalmist talks, doesn't he, about those who trust in chariots. Well, the Egyptians, boy, they trust in chariots. Their chariots are the best chariots that you will find anywhere. They are the super-duper military vehicles of the ancient world. And they serve the Egyptians well, then, in terms of catching up with the Israelites, don't they? The Israelites get off to a head start, we know, as they leave Goshen. It's only sometime afterwards that the Egyptians decide they're going to pursue, and they're able to catch up with these people because they're in chariots. The Israelites aren't in chariots, they're walking. And so the chariots serve the Egyptians well immediately. They're able to very quickly catch up with the people they want to re-enslave. And so, the chariots having served them so well in catching up with the Israelites, what better way of finishing the job off than actually rounding up the Israelites using their chariots? Well, the problem is, of course, that by that stage, the Israelites are in the middle of the sea. And the bed of the sea then is firm enough, obviously, for them to walk over readily enough. But it's going to be soft just below the surface where the chariot wheels, the heavy chariot wheels, will penetrate. And so in verse 25, the inevitable happens and these chariot wheels become clogged up in the mud just below the surface of the seabed. And the Egyptians can't ride them any further. And this resource then of the Egyptians, which seemed to make them so irresistible, so formidable, so indomitable, so invincible, this very resource is the thing that ultimately undoes them. Egypt's asset rebounds. And then the second little touch, Egypt's army reappears. Egypt's army reappears. Now, in a very sort of Hebrew way, there are points of connection between the beginning of our passage and the end of our passage. I mentioned earlier in the sermon this morning that the Hebrew writers are into their little devices, their little literary flourishes. And this is another way that the Hebrews wrote then. They would kind of envelope accounts, and there would be points of contact between the beginning and the end. And so verses 13 and 14, the beginning of our passage this morning, kind of connects up in different ways with verses 30 and 31. But in each case, there's a kind of little twist involved. So you notice that in verse 13, at the beginning there, Moses says to the people, "Fear not, fear not." Well, fear is precisely what the Israelites end up doing at the end of the passage. But of course, there's a twist, because they're not now fearing the Egyptians. There's nothing to fear there anymore. They're now fearing Yahweh. This is a healthy fear, a fear of the God who has shown his power so magnificently. Or then again, You notice how Moses says at the beginning there in verse 14, the Lord will fight for you and you have only to be silent. I don't think that's quite the sense here. It's more like, and you will hold your peace. You will hold your peace. And I think it refers to the fact the Israelites had just been complaining so vociferously and saying, why have you brought us out here to die in the wilderness? And Moses says, look, God's going to do something here and that will make you hold your peace. You'll be silent then. And of course, the little twist there is that what happens at the end is that the Israelites are anything but silent, as we'll see next week. But they're no longer complaining. They're singing now. They're singing songs of praise to the God who has acted on their behalf. So there are those little points of contact and those little twists. But then the other one that I'm really interested in here is Moses' words there at the end of verse 13, the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. So he's saying the Egyptians are going to disappear now. They're going to disappear. What a cheering prospect that must have been for the Israelites. But of course, actually, in the end, they do. The Israelites do see the Egyptians again. Israel saw the Egyptians, it says at the end of verse 30. Egypt's army reappears. What was Moses talking about then? Did he oversell the whole situation? No. This appearance of the Egyptians at the end is even better than the disappearance that Moses had initially foretold, because it says Israel saw the Egyptians what? Dead. Dead on the seashore. There's something better than disappearance here. It's the reappearance of the Egyptian army, utterly dead. And those two emphases then that I've just quickly mentioned there, I think they have their counterparts when it comes to our enemy that I talked about at the start of the sermon this morning. Our enemy from whom God saves us. What is his best asset that he has to use against us as God's people? What is Satan's foremost asset? Well, the book of Revelation refers to it, doesn't it? In a title it gives to Satan. He's the accuser, Revelation 12. He's the accuser. That's his best asset. His ability, his brilliant ability to accuse you and me. And boy, there's plenty in our lives for him to accuse us of, isn't there? There's plenty of material for him to work with. But listen to these glorious words of Martin Luther in his commentary on Galatians. Luther pictures a dialogue between the believer and Satan. And he writes, when the devil tells us we are sinners and therefore damned, we may answer, because you say I am a sinner, I will be saved. Then the devil will say, no, you will be damned. And I will reply, no, for I fly to Christ, who has given himself for my sins. Therefore, Satan, you will not prevail against me when you try to terrify me by telling me how great my sins are. On the contrary, when you say I am a sinner, you give me armor and weapons against yourself, so that I can cut your throat with your own sword and tread you under my feet, for Christ died for sinners. So when you say I am a sinner, you do not terrify me, but comfort me immeasurably. Isn't that wonderful? Satan's best weapon is accusing you and me. And yet that is his very undoing. It's the very thing that causes Luther comfort, immeasurable comfort. You're a sinner, Satan says. Wonderful. Christ died for sinners. And like the Egyptian army, Satan then will not finally disappear quietly. I suppose closure is the word, isn't it, that sums up what we're talking about here. As the Israelites walked along that beach at the end of our passage, amidst these corpses lying there, strewn across the sand, as the Israelites walked along that beach, it provided satisfying closure, didn't it? In the relationship that they had had for years with this vile oppressor. That's why it's better than the Egyptians just disappearing quietly. It's better, there's closure here. There's closure as the dead bodies lie on the Red Sea shore. And there's going to be closure in the relationship with our vile enemy. At Time Out on Tuesday, we were talking about this. Remember Paul's words there in Romans 16, verse 20. The God of peace will soon crush Satan under your feet. And it's the significance, I think, of Paul saying in 1 Corinthians 6, 3, that the saints will judge the angels, not primarily the angels who serve God faithfully, the fallen angels, the demonic angels, Satan and his chums. During lockdown last year, perhaps you just suddenly noticed after several weeks, perhaps you noticed quicker than that if you live in a certain part of the region, you suddenly noticed that you hadn't heard an aeroplane for ages. And you hadn't really realised, but then you just suddenly think, oh yeah, I haven't heard a plane roaring as it takes off from the airport, as it's coming to land. I haven't heard one for ages. It will not be the case that after we've been in the new world for some time, we'll kind of say to a friend, oh, I've just thought, I haven't heard anything about Satan for a while. Yeah, of course, he must be in hell, I suppose, now, just as God's word always said he would be. It won't be like that. Rather, we shall step over the threshold into that new world, having already with our own hands cast Satan into hell. That's the biblical picture. There's going to be closure. We shall tread across the threshold of the new world with blood on our feet because we'll have just crushed the serpent. That's what Paul is saying in Romans 16. We will see him and his demise as we take up our inheritance. And so, Egypt's complete failure here. It's not just something to enjoy and laugh at. It's something to cheer our hearts. Because what happened to the Egyptians is going to happen to Satan and all his demons. It's happening already. Their best asset is rebounding. Constantly. Every time they try to accuse you. And it will happen on the day when there's closure and we, with our Saviour, cast all that is evil into the lake of fire. May God bless his word to us. Amen.